Hi, I'm Barbara B., and I'm a grateful, recovering, compulsive overeater. Oh, my gosh. You know, I spent most of my life wanting my family to understand me and to get what I say, and here I am with this whole new family who understands me and gets what I'm going to say, you know, which is a very beautiful thing. Thank you. Otherwise, you know, if I didn't think of you as family, I'd be up here and my little knees would be knocking, and it would be pretty powerful. I mean, in a not so good way. So anyhow, so what it was like, I grew up in a household in Pennsylvania where we had dessert 5 times a day. We had dessert for breakfast, for lunch, after school, for dinner, and before bed. You didn't think you could do it 5 times a day, did you? Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what I grew up with. You know, I had diabetes all around me in my family and alcoholism all around me in my family. And there was, you know, I remember one time we were making cookies for Christmas, and I remember taking the sugar and letting it pour through my fingers and going, oh, isn't this beautiful? It's so clean and pure and white. I'm so glad I didn't become a cocaine addict. You know, that would have, as my daughter used to tell me, you'd have been an ugly cocaine addict, Mom. So anyhow, so, you know, we just chowed down, you know, and whenever, I was one of those kids with wide swings of emotions, and in my family it was pretty safe to be right here in the middle, but if I got too excited, they wanted me to calm down. And if I got too sad and cried, then they wanted me to be Susie Sunshine, you know? And so I learned, which I could see from this point of view, I couldn't tell, I didn't know it then, but when I was really excited, then I learned to eat the creamy, sugary things. Brought me right down. It was titration for all the nurses. You know, I was just titrating. You know, and when I was really down, man, chocolate. Boom, right back up again. Ah, I can do it. I'm fine. I was the hero child in my alcoholic family. You know, and so my mom in the mid-50s actually divorced my dad. You know, they had been married in the Catholic rectory. So in the 50s, and they were married Catholic. And she had the courage and the strength to say to him, you know, too much alcohol, and you've never met a woman in this town you didn't love. So I think you better go, you know. And excuse me if I forget you guys are over there. Okay, thanks. And I just think that's the bravest thing. And she's not one of those, you know, out there women, but she just pulled herself together and took care of business. So, and then, you know, whenever I just sort of became her partner, you know, and I didn't know it then. I just knew that I had to be the best little girl in town. Because, you know, she was a teacher and then she was a guidance counselor, and I didn't want anybody to ever say that she messed up being a mom, you know, because she was divorced. You know, and so I ran really fast. I tap danced really fast to try to be the best little girl in town, you know. And unfortunately, I succeeded quite a bit, you know. And so when you succeed at something, you keep doing it. You know, it's positive reinforcement. And so I kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And the more I put myself out there, the more sugar I had to ingest, you know, to keep myself going, to fuel this rocket ship, you know. And so the other thing that went right along with the sugar for me and my family was raging codependence, you know. And I have friends in many different fellowships because I am an equal opportunity addict. We'll talk about that in a minute. And you know, when I share, when I tell my story, I have to talk about all those programs that I'm in, because it's my story. And if I just talked about OA, my recovery would have been very partial, and you would only get a partial story of, you know, who this person is. So I have no idea what I was saying when I went off on that tangent, because I'm 65. I was 65 on Friday, by the way. I knew I would get that in somewhere. Anyhow, so... Huh? Yes. Whatever you say. Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes. Equal. I'm so glad. Everybody else in the back is, you know, post-lunch snooze back there. No, I'm kidding. So Yes, I was an equal opportunity addict, and the biggest thing in my family besides the sugar was raging codependence. You know, and so when I go to my other programs, what I love to tell the women there is that, you know, food and people came first. Even before we were born, it was food and people. You know, all that other stuff showed up much later, even if it was only 5 or 6 years later, you know, much later. And so we're the real heroes. I have never met braver people in my life than people who come to OA, followed really closely by Al-Anon people. Never met braver people in my life. It's a wonderful thing. So, you know, I just went off to college, and I was so thrilled that I didn't have to, you know, be under the little nose peeking of my mama, who used to say to me, "Are you sure you want another one of those?" And I was always sure. Who is she thinking she was talking to? I was always sure I wanted, and in fact, I wanted the rest of them that were in the kitchen that weren't out on the plate yet. Come on. So that was pretty cool. So I went to college, and I promptly gained 25 pounds between August and Thanksgiving and never noticed. I was having a good time. You know, I was in my little tiny high school, and, you know, the boys hadn't noticed me, and I went away to this much, you know, this bigger college, and all these other people didn't know my history of that I was just the girlfriend, not the girlfriend, you know, and so nobody had told them that, and so they saw me differently, and I was like, oh, that's cute, that's good. So I just ate my way, you know, the mystery meat at dinner, you know, in the cafeterias at college. I ate all those meals, plus I would go out every night and eat something else with somebody, you know, and so it just went from there, and I went home, and wow. So on and on and on, and I, you know, I found alcohol in college. And I found men, because I was going to be a virgin when I got married. I was determined to be a virgin when I got married, because I was not going to be my dad. I was not going to be that drinker, and I was not going to be that person whose sexuality was way out in front, you know? And wrong. Wrong. So I would go back and forth between being my mom, who was so good, and my dad, who was so bad, you know? And I couldn't find me. And Barbara was somewhere in the middle, but she wasn't going to come out to play for a while, you know, until I settled down a little bit, which took years, you know. So fast forward, I married my starter husband, which was a big mistake. It was blissfully short. He left me in 18 months, and I was devastated. I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, and it was actually the best because I met my for-real husband. And so we were going to get married, and I rented a wedding dress because we had no money, and it was this beautiful princess dress, and it had covered buttons down the back. Women know what I'm talking about. I took out the darts, and I still couldn't get them buttoned. And a friend of mine said, "Well, why don't you try OA?" Okay, so I went to the meeting. I was obviously really nervous because I couldn't find the hospital. Now, I live in Fremont. It's not that big. There's one big hospital, or there was at the time, on the main street. I lived right at the other end of the street. I couldn't find that hospital for my first meeting. So I must have known there was something going on, you know. But, I cried through my first couple meetings, and I thought, well, this is pretty good. But, you know, 12 steps, 12 weeks, I get thin, I get into the dress, I'm out of here. That was in 1983. Yeah. So and I kept going. You know, I did. I got into the dress. I got married. And I married a black belt Al-Anon. And, boy, you know, there was nothing I could do to piss him off because he had had, you know, a really wild woman that he was married to the first time around. It was like I was like this little mosquito on his shoulder. And I'd do my best. I'd give it my best worst, you know. And it would be like, really? And so I stopped because what's the point? You know, and I kept eating, and I kept drinking, and I kept going to meetings, just OA at the time, and I didn't get a sponsor, and I didn't want to talk to anybody and make friends, and I didn't read the literature, and I didn't work the steps for 5 years, but I tried with all my might to quit eating sugar, And I would do it for a while. I'd just white knuckle it, and then I'd go back to Pennsylvania to the scene of the original crime, you know? And my mother was in the same house, and all the goodies were exactly in the same place where they used to be. And I'd go right back again. And then I would binge for about 6 months, and then I would get really sick of myself, and I would, you know, and I would, not, I don't think I was absent. I was just dieting. I was like holding on, you know, like I can do this. So I did that for 5 years, you know, and I'm a smart woman. You know, it has nothing to do with intelligence. You know, it's like, it's a disease. You know, I was a smart, sick woman. So, finally one day I was going to a fourth step workshop. I finally decided it was about time to start doing my steps and get a sponsor. And so I drove down to this fourth step workshop, and I had never written down what I was going to abstain from. And I had tried to abstain from sugar while still drinking. Never occurred to me that sugar is, you know, alcohol is liquid sugar. So there was that kept it going in my body. And there was the part of me that kind of went, oh, you don't like me fat? Well, fooey on you. I'm eating sugar. You know, nobody cared what I looked like but me, you know. So anyhow, I wrote it down. No alcohol, no sugar. That was September 9th, 1988. And, you know, it's been amazing. And my food plan has gone up and down since then, different ways and whatever. Somebody spoke this morning and said that he had gained weight in program. Twice I gained 35 pounds. Going to meetings, nobody said to me, honey, are things okay? You know, we know that when people gain weight, it's usually there's something going on that they're not dealing with. What can I help you with? You know, I'm here to listen. I love you. You know, because we're so afraid of hurting somebody's feelings. You know, I would rather hurt somebody's feelings than watch them die. I just would, you know. And so the first time, it had to do with me not knowing that I needed to give up carbs, too. You know, who knew? You know, I was eating low fat and no sugar, and I was gaining weight. And I thought, well, I'm just a happy, you know, married lady. Happy married ladies get a little fat, you know, no big deal. And so I found out about the carbs and that it applied to me, and it pissed me off because I had to give up one more thing and I didn't want to. And so I worked on that, and 35 pounds off in 1 year without changing a whole lot. You know, I just changed what I needed to, you know. And then the second time was, my husband got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2003. And, you know, anybody who's loved somebody with cancer, you know, you go and you sit while they get chemo, and you sit with them at home because they don't have any energy to go out, and you sit with them here. And my butt just kept spreading because I was sitting, you know. And I wasn't eating much different, but I was, for me, when I hold on to something, I hold on to the weight. The numbers on the scale go up and stay up when I'm holding on. And the minute I start to pray about, please God help me, you know, I let go, everything lets go, if you know what I mean. And the weight goes down again. It's what I call a standard 12-step miracle. You know, they're all around us. I don't think anything has really changed in my life. It's just that I see things now. You know, they were playing a song a little bit ago, and when I was sitting there waiting to come up here, and it was a song that my 16-year-old granddaughter used to dance to. And I thought, she's here. She's here. And the day that I did my first retreat, somebody, Henry called one of my friends who went down to Arizona with me and said, would you buy her some roses? And there were roses on my podium. So he's here, too. Because I didn't mention, he died in 2008. And I didn't have to compulsively overeat. I didn't take back the alcohol. I didn't take back the sugar. I didn't go crazy and, you know, go out with anybody who looked at me crooked. You know, I just said, okay, God, I don't know how to do this. Because he was the only man I had been with at all since I was sober and abstinent. You know, I had never danced with anybody else. I had never made love to anybody else. I had never, you know, tried to make a partnership with anybody else. And so, pretty scary. You know, all of a sudden, how old was I? So, 57? And I felt like a teenager. you know, it's like I'm 16 all over again. And that hasn't changed a whole lot, but, you know, I'm breathing better about it now. So I decided I had to start walking the damn dog, you know, because I didn't walk the damn dog before. And the damn dog was 90 pounds. And he had the cutest smile. And he would sit in front of me like, you know. I know you guys can't see what I did, but I just made a funny doggy face. And it was wonderful. And so I started, you know, to walk the damn dog and fell more and more in love with the dog and lost 35 pounds in a year again, you know. Because I was, well, freak, I was about this weight when I came into OA. And I thought that I was the fattest, most disgusting, yucky. I did not want to wear a bathing suit. It was like total body distortion. It was nuts. And when I put sugar in my mouth in the morning, all I wanted to do the whole rest of the day was look for more sugar. It was drug-seeking behavior. I understand heroin addicts. I totally get it. You know, it's like all day long. Where can I get the next? What's it going to be? How much can I eat without people knowing that I've already eaten it? You know, how can I replace it? You know, I used to know how to spoon the ice cream off the top so that my mom would never know that I had been in there. And I would sneak out. They'd be in the living room watching Perry Como or Gunsmoke or something, and which was not totally interesting to me. And I'd sneak into the kitchen because addicts have addict behavior. You know, I would sneak in the kitchen, open the drawer, take out the spoon, open the freezer, take out the ice cream, scoop right into my mouth, scoop. And I'd listen, and I knew that at any moment they could come in and find me, you know. And so when I was done, you know, I closed it up, put it back in the freezer, went over, washed the spoon, put it back, and just went back in and sat in the living room feeling much better. Who knew that was addict behavior? I didn't know. I just thought I was getting away with something. You know, and when you're the good girl, it's really fun to get away with something, you know. So anyhow, once I really got into this whole thing about no alcohol and no sugar and working steps and having a sponsor and having sponsees, and you know, things have changed so much for me since 1983. I mean, it's half my life ago. I can't believe how long it's been since 1983. You know, it's crazy. And all the old people are going like this. Oh, so anyhow. So, being an equal opportunity addict is, I think is part of why I never got really heavy, really into alcohol so that I was a falling down drunk every day, really into codependence so that people wanted to just punch me. Well, sometimes, but not every day. By the way, I still only carry a 24-hour chip for Al-Anon because I never go a day without a codependent slip, ever. So it keeps me humble, you know, 24 hours. So when I looked at this, I thought, okay, how is this happening? You know, and so I pictured a field with a farmer, okay? And the field's all level, you know, he's done whatever farmers do to fields to make them all level and wonderful. And all of a sudden this gopher comes up through this hole. And the hole is called compulsive overeating. And the farmer gets furious, takes the shovel, runs over to the hole, whams the gopher on the head, fills in the hole, and says, ha, no way. You're not going to get me again. All the times I ever said, I will never be so stupid as to do this again. I know what hurts me, I'm not going to do it. And I always did until the abstinence kicked in, until God kicked my abstinence in. And but the gopher, which is the disease, is still running under the field. And then he comes up through the hole called compulsive spending. You know, well, I was making no money at all as a social worker in Philadelphia investigating child abuse in all the high rises, you know, and I went a little crazy with my credit cards, and every paycheck for about a year, I was down to 5 cents or something in my checking account till I paid off all those bills, you know, very scary. So farmer comes over, whams the gopher on the head and starts to, you know, fill in the pile and says, okay, that's not going to happen again. But the gopher's still running. And the gopher comes up through the hole called alcohol, you know? And then, you know, for some people, it's too much sleep. For some people, it's, you know, drugs. It's, you know, cigarettes. It's reading books. I mean, I know people who really have a, think that they have a problem with just, they'll just take a novel and just read it. And then when it's over, kind of get scared because, oh my God, this is, now there's life, you know, and pick up the next novel, you know, really quick, you know, and I can do that one too. You know, when you have a gopher that's running, you find lots of holes, you know. And now I won't say I'd never come up through those holes, but I know the difference now. I can get back down under without the farmer hitting me on the head, you know. And sometimes my gopher just goes to sleep, which is such a beautiful thing. You know, it's peace and serenity. My gopher just goes to sleep, which is so good. So another part of my story is that, you know, I had worked my steps. I had been going to program. I go to 3 meetings a week. And I was at a pretty good place. You know, I've been reading, you know, recovery books and doing everything I knew how to do. I was abstinent. I was sober. And I was so depressed, I didn't know what to do. And one morning I was watching the Today Show, and this is how I jogged, just like this in my living room. I thought that was really cool. You know, I was really doing exercise, you know. And I was watching Matt Lauer on the Today Show, and he was talking about this whole ferry full of people on the Nile in Egypt, and the ferry capsized, and all those people got eaten by crocodiles. I could not stop crying. I mean, obviously, it's a sad thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's a horrible thing. But I couldn't stop crying. And I thought, I think this is a little weird. You know, I think this is sort of an overreaction. You know, and so I finally decided, well, maybe I ought to, you know, go to a shrink and find out what's what. You know, and I had even been in therapy a couple of times. But it never stuck because I would get to a place where I didn't want to be anymore. I was getting a little too real, you know. And so I would decide that the therapist was kind of dumb and I would leave, you know. So I didn't want to go to this psychiatrist. And my husband said to me, you know, just make the appointment. You don't have to go. And if you go, you can just sit in the parking lot. You don't have to go in. Or if you go in, you can leave the waiting room. You have choices all the way along. So just take the first step. Just do whatever, you know? And I did, and I went over, and because I'm a social worker, I wrote out my whole history. I had pages, you know? And I went in, and I put my head down, and I read it to him, because I was ashamed. I was ashamed, you know? There was never any way I would ever have been good enough, no matter how hard I tried, no matter how fast I ran or tap danced. I was never going to be good enough. And I looked up, and this man was crying. And he said to me, I have no idea how you have accomplished so much, so depressed. And then I started to cry. And, you know, the upshot is that I've been on medication for over 20 years, and, you know, it has saved my life. It has improved the quality of my life so much. I probably could have climbed the mountains that I've climbed, but it felt like I was climbing them in 50-pound boots. And I'd have maybe gotten to the top, but there would have been no quality of life. I'd have been exhausted. There would have been no barber left, you know? And the problems are all still there. The feelings are all still there. Now I have a chance. That's what it's been like for me. You know, I don't know how it is for anybody else. All I can tell you is my story. So I needed, you know, in the big book it says, you know, do what you need to do. This program isn't everything. And so I found a therapist that actually I've been seeing her 15 out of the last 17 years. Some of us are sicker than others. Or maybe some of us are weller than others, you know? Who knows? But I found somebody who had great boundaries and who knew how to call bullshit on me when I was doing my little, oh, I'm fine. You know, she's like, oh, come on, really? So those two things have helped me a lot, that and just continuing to, you know, and to do service. You know, I do the tools. The hardest one for me is the telephone. My MO is to call the next day and say, wow, I had a terrible day yesterday, but I got through it. You know, I'm not going to be vulnerable enough to tell you, you know, that I'm a mess right now. So I'm working on that one. That's a yet. I'm working on that one. So, in the morning, I say, the first three steps. And I, because in my infinite wisdom, I knew really how better to write the steps than Bill did. I changed them just a little to fit me. Okay. So, we admitted we were powerless over food, et cetera, that our lives had become unmanageable. I just stopped at we. You know, when I first went, I did not want to be part of we. I wanted to do it by myself. Thank you very much. You know, I didn't want you to know what a mess I was. I didn't want to know. That was the biggest thing doing the fifth step. The thing about telling God and, you know, another human being and myself. Myself was the one. And then when I got to the character defects, I would say to my friends, oh, my God, do you know, I found out I'm very controlling. And they went, yeah. And I said, oh, you knew. Thank you. And you still like me. And they said, yeah, get over it, you know. Just work your program. So, you know, it was a beautiful thing. People are very forgiving. You know, they're very kind and forgiving. So I just wanted to stop at the we, because the next word is admitted. I don't want to admit anything. You know, I just wanted to just kind of roll through my life. And, you know, if I had to admit something, if it was right in front of me, okay, you caught me. Busted being human, you know. So, and I did not want to admit that my life was unmanageable, because that totally went against the persona, you know. But what do you call a person who while they're driving, if the sugary stuff falls off the seat next and goes on the floor, driving with one hand, trying to get the cookies back up on the seat with the other hand? Now, normal people don't do that. You know, I was, you know, people, you know, it's so funny, because I really think that a lot of the AAs and the NAs are a little bit afraid to come into these, you know, really bottom line programs, and they'll say, oh, nobody ever got arrested for fat driving. And then I tell them exactly what I had done, and somebody should have arrested me. I was not driving safely then. It was crazy. I was totally, that's all I wanted right there. I didn't care if I ran into anybody, you know. So, came to believe that a power far greater than ourselves, because I need to make my higher power really big. One time my husband was out in this boat, and he was like 3 hours late coming in off the ocean in this little tiny boat with his friend. And I remember sitting on the couch and getting up and saying, okay, God, I know I need to be on my knees, but give me 5 minutes with the ice cream first. Honest to God, that's what I heard in my brain. And I went, whoa, you are in trouble. You in trouble, girl. You know, that was before September 9th, 1988, you know. Little things like that, you know, a sane person would go, okay, something needs to change right now. Those of us who are addicts and not quite well, it takes a while for it to sink in, for us to be willing, you know. So I had to have a higher power that was bigger than a carton of ice cream. And he has shown himself to me, so that's wonderful. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And then I add the 11th step part, praying only for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. Because I think that goes really well with the third step, don't you? Yeah, thanks. Okay, so when I first really started to get that third step, it was like no one has ever asked me to do anything bigger in my whole life than to make a decision to turn my will and my life, not just sugar, not just alcohol, not just crazy men, you know, not just people that I want to control, my will and my life over to the care of a loving God, not somebody or something or some whatever that wants to rule me, you know, and just make everything terrible for me. The care of a loving God who just wants better for me than I could ever imagine for myself, ever. You know, and praying only for the knowledge of his will, you know, and the power to carry it out. That's pretty big. That's pretty big. You know, I get to have my thoughts and my feelings, but when things really work, pretty much I say, you know what? You know what I want and what I think and what I feel before I even say it out loud or even in my head. So there it is. And thy will not mine be done. Amen. You know, I was horribly nervous a little while ago till I got it that you guys were my family. And And I started saying the third step prayer, you know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. And I thought, you know, this is not about Barbara's ego. This is about, I was telling my friends, I'm going to stand up there and go with my mouth open and just go, come on, God, come on. But, you know, I'm the one that has to form the words and let them through, you know. So life is a beautiful thing, and I am happy to say the third step prayer and to really mean it. And what I'm looking forward to is being able to continue to say it and mean it at deeper and deeper levels. Because every time I think I know what, like, friendship is about, God shows me another layer that I never even knew was available. It wasn't that I wasn't doing it because I was being stubborn or I couldn't. It was I didn't even know it was there to be done. And then it's like, whoa, okay, all right, well, let's try this, you know? And which makes it exciting. You know, I hope to be in these programs every day for the rest of my life, you know, because I keep learning and I keep finding new things that are challenging, you know, and I keep meeting new wonderful human beings who are willing to open their hearts and their lives to me. I mean, what a gift. You know, where else do people get to do that? I mean, I'm sure there are some places, but not like us. So anyhow, I think I'm done. Thank you very much. Thank you.